This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
This is Recode Media with Peter Kafka. That is me. I'm not at Vox headquarters in New York City. I'm like four blocks north in a Trump building.
I know.
You guys know this is the Trump building?
I did not.
It's a Trump building. I'm with Benny and Josh Safdie. They're the directors and creators of Uncut Gems, which I think you probably heard about at this point because you guys have been doing endless promotion. So thank you for including me on your tour.
Of course.
You may also know this as the Adam Sandler isn't funny in this movie.
But he's pretty funny.
He is very funny in this movie. Kevin Garnett's in this movie.
Johnny's nodding. He knows he's funny.
It's great. If you haven't seen it, go see it. It's entertaining. Can we call it fun?
Absolutely.
It's fun. Okay.
Yeah. It's a wild
ride. Spend 10 years on something, it better be fun.
It better be
fun to watch for me and everything that I look for in entertainment.
It's okay, so you have a very specific idea of entertainment because this is also described as like a heart attack of a movie, two-hour panic
attack.
Makes
you feel alive. You know, it's like a defibrillator.
I think of it as the part of the roller coaster where you're going up.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Just for about 2 hours of that. Like, something's going to happen, and it keeps going. And you guys... Is it fair to say that's sort of a trademark of the kind of movies you make?
I guess, I don't know.
You know what, I was trying to talk to Ronald Bronstein about this. I was actually talking to him about it this morning. We're now, as we've made at least the last 2.5, actually, heaven knows what has fallen. I mean, Daddy Long Legs is that as well. I remember when we showed Daddy Long Legs to this French distributor.
Sort of your first feature,
This
right?
was our first feature, yeah. There's a part in the movie where Ronnie's character basically administers some sleeping medicine to his kids so that they sleep a little later in the next day.
Understandable and terrible.
Yeah. But then it's that he leaves the apartment to go do stuff.
But this French distributor guy, we were like, you know, it was half paid for that movie. And there was this like international buyer, big company. And we showed him the movie and he said, once the main character did that, he goes, I could watch this guy take a shit and I'd be interested. And
that's true.
And he said, I said, well, why do you feel that way? He goes, I don't know. He laced every millisecond with tension because I was thinking, I know he meant well with it. He wanted to shield his kids from the horror of waking up and being alone. But the byproduct of the lack of foresight and the lack of research was frustrating to him and it made him so curious. So my point is, I think that we've been working on these movies, and I think just a natural attraction to a certain energy and vibe has kind of developed into this kind of diamond-shaped tension. And I think that, you know, I've always responded to thrillers.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's what we did is we made like a pretty tense thriller. But then we have the thing that makes it so entertaining for me is that I've never... you have this tense thriller, but you have these like strange moments of comedy that are like, they're not like funny ha-ha. They're like, people are actually laughing and that's very cool.
I was talking with Ronnie and he said, there's a compulsion to not have people be bored to such an extent that it's almost like a fault. You know, like we always want to keep it entertaining. So we keep the edits so lean and everything. And at one point does that become... Like a there's something wrong with you.
I don't know. Your version of entertaining is, here's a character, something bad is happening to him, and then it gets worse, and then it gets worse, and then it gets worse, and you keep waiting for, like, relief, like, for it to work out, and spoiler, it doesn't tend to work out, at least in the movies I've seen.
I think it works out a little bit for Howard in the movie.
All right, I don't want to spoil it. Does anyone come to you and say, look, we'd love you to do this kind of project, but it's going to be very different from what you do. We want to bring that energy that you have, but we want to make it more accessible.
I'll say this. So Scott Rudin, who came onto the project 3 years ago, you know, who has an incredible pedigree of films going back to when he was like a early running studios when he was like 20-something years old, you know, from The Firm to, you know, most recently to like Lady Bird, you know what I mean? So he responded to the energy and he won and he pushed us. You know, we had a, I won't call it languid, but we had a kind of stretched out first act. And he pushed us to make it an avalanche. And he pushed us often, like, I remember we were shooting, second day of the shoot, we were shooting this scene between Howard and Julia out the window where he's passing her a bag. And it was above 47th Street. And it was a pretty crazy, from a technical standpoint, it's crane off the top of the roof. And he saw, I remember he was nervous about us shooting something close to the ending on such an early day. And I told him not to worry about it. And then he saw the dailies and he voiced concern immediately. He's like, it's not intense enough. And he goes, you have to reshoot it. And I said, well, we can't reshoot it. Our schedule is so tough. He's like, well, let's think about it at the end. Maybe we'll put it on the stage. We'll rebuild that outside. I was like, oh, no, I definitely don't want to do that. I want to shoot it on location. And I thought we did a great job because in this moment, Howard isn't intense. Howard is actually very calm and collected, and he knows exactly what his fate. Yeah. Exactly. He's in the center of the storm. And we tried to explain to him that everything also, around it is actually really and intense and crazy.
That's the one moment where nobody else knows what's going on except for him. You know, he's in total control in that moment.
But I bring it up because it was an example of someone, you know, from on high, someone with great experience, Scott Rudin, pushing us to go push the intensity of the film.
Make it more intense.
Yeah, which was, it was a, you know, I don't know, there was something about that. Hearing somebody from his point of view pushing us to do that was fortifying, but it was also, you know, we were thinking this the other day. It's like, I don't know if we're going to continue to go on and make movies that are quote unquote intense or quote unquote stressful. We have a certain genetic DNA or that makes us, all me, Benny, and Ronnie in particular, stressed out people. So I think naturally we're going to kind of go towards that pole. But
there's not going to be a movie set in California with buddies and...
You know, I would... If we did, it would be like a Don't Harsh My Buzz type movie.
Uh-huh. You guys said this movie took 10 years to make. Stars Adam Sandler. You've done movies in between. Was it that you got distracted and wanted to do other projects? Did you always need Adam Sandler and was getting him
that
for 10
was
years?
That was one thing, is we always wanted him. But it was also just... We didn't have kind of the credibility to get the budget and everything necessary to make Gems when we wanted to. So it kept getting pushed.
Because this is what, your third feature?
This is our fifth, right?
Well, no. You got Daddy, Heaven.
Lenny Cook.
Good Time. It's our fourth. I mean, if you include the feature, if you include the doc, it's five. Yes.
Yeah. But you guys are sort of out of film school. You start making. Yeah. And you start we wrote a
screenplay while... started writing it still basically in school. And I remember there was this person we were working with who was older than us, and she was met through, what's the name? How do you say? Friends of Bob? What do you mean? What's the term?
Yeah.
And she took us under her wing, and she was like bringing us around. We were really young. We would go into these rooms, and we would pitch this. It was a script about the same characters in Daddy Long Legs, except it all took place on a beach. And it was kind of like a strange, loose adaptation of Odysseus. And it would be fun. There was a Brazilian person who wanted to take it and make it one day. But I remember we went out and tried to make that movie, and we were like, all we wanted was a few $100,000 to go and make this movie. And I remember at one point we did a table read for these lawyers and hedge fund people who met through the
investors.
Grapevine.
Yeah.
And we had to read it, and they brought like a person of authority to like be like to listen to this reading, and it was like us, the DP, our buddy Brett, Sammy, our production designer Gems, and we all read like every character, and then these people were in like a boardroom on like a Saturday. Then they brought someone as an authority to like kind of give a sober point of view on the script that was being read, and it was like a seventh. I don't even remember her character on Footloose, like someone who was like a C plot subplot character on Footloose, and she liked the script. Yeah. She actually vouched for it. She's actually pretty entertaining.
I think I was maybe 20 years old, and the guy's like, "Look, I'm not giving these guys like 100 grand to go have fun on a beach."
That's how he looked at it. And then they wanted us to spin it into like, if you make it about 9/11, we'll pay for it. It's like 9/11. This movie's nothing to do with 9/11. And then whatever, Benny had this idea.
I don't even want to talk about it.
Okay.
It's not even necessary.
It was
either way
to make it include 9/11 for the budget.
But it was partly a joke, and the guy took it seriously. Either way,
that scarred us because
it's like we wrote down this script.
Was that the first time you'd sort of like done a pass the can in front of like money guys before?
Yeah, well, and it was just like, okay, this is what happens. You spend all this time on this script, and then you go through this whole process, and it kind of kills.
And a rich person
the
says,
desire.
Add a dog or something.
Yeah. And then it just kills your desire to do anything with it. And then the script just kind of sat there and languished. And it was always.
But then we met Andy Spade through our buddy Casey Neistat. He said, "Hey, I can get you X amount. I can get you the budget if you give me 48 hours. And I said, "All right, you got 48 hours. I didn't even care if it was 60 hours. But that's the Casey's way. He was like, 48 hours, I'm going to get it. And on the 47th hour, he told me, I remember I was sick, like Benny is now. And much sicker, actually. And he's like, "Meet me in your car at this old Volvo." He's like, "Meet me in your car on the corner of Worth and Broadway at 9 a.m. on this." And I was like, "What?" He's like, "And pack for the weekend." And I was like, "What is going on?" He's like, "Oh, and bring your package, the short films, all that stuff." And we drove out to meet Andy Spade and his wife, Kate Spade. And we spent a weekend with him. And it was very magical in the sense that like this guy was he was like out of a Chaplin film, like City Lights almost. He was very nurturing. He loved our short films, and he read this script that took place on the beach. He's like, "All right, I got an idea. You're gonna do a short commercial for Kate Spade, and you're only gonna spend $10,000 on that short, and then you're gonna take the remainder of the budget, $180,000, and you're gonna put that into a feature." Yeah, exactly. And you know, of course, it's a long story, but my point is that was like Andy then became Andy and Kate ended up becoming like, you know, very involved in basically giving us work for the next 3-4 years and also funding our features. Don't remember how we got started on this, but it was.
I was asking about the journey, but this is actually kind of where I wanted to go. Idea that eventually is so you guys are making movies, but you're intimately involved in every part of it, right? You're raising every dollar. You're bringing your friends to do production work. Was that how you imagined movies were going to work when you started playing around with cameras?
That's the only way we could make stuff happen was if your friends were all on board to make it work, because you had to convince everybody, "Hey, this is worthwhile." And that's like a good starting point.
I think that's in the DNA of the work, and in particular with Uncut Gems, because there's this decade-long journey behind the actual film. It was by the time we had, you know, this major union film that we were shooting in New York and we were showing up on 47th Street, everyone on the crew that was showing up to projects they were used to, and this is not to disparage any of their projects, some of the projects are great, but they're showing up to these projects that are kind of like these tent cities, you know what I mean? They're like constructed and built and then they're gone. They were showing up to this and they're showing up on 47th Street and they're seeing relationships that go back 8-9 years between one of the producers or myself and a shopkeeper or some guy who made a piece of jewelry for the film 8 years ago, and now they're showing up and they can't believe their own eyes that it's actually happening. So the DNA of us trying to DIY the film for so long actually bled into the megastructure of the movie in a way that I think it really helped it.
Yeah, and it's also, I'll also run Boom on this, even though that's how we did all the movies prior. It's like on a major movie.
So that's a very for people who don't know, that's holding up the microphone.
Yes, yeah. That's a very strange thing to do on the set.
Well, and it isn't strange for me. For other people, but it's strange.
For a director to do that is a strange thing. So when everybody shows up, there's all of that combined with this feeling that we don't ever leave the set.
Hey, this is Peter. We're going to break into this conversation for a quick minute. We're going to hear from a sponsor. We'll be right back with the Safdies.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline. Because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Okay, now we're going to go back to the Safdie brothers.
Do you guys ever wish, boy, I wish we could just write the thing and direct it and then someone else takes care of everything?
Not even a little bit.
Like a regular movie.
Well, listen, production is the worst experience of life. It is grueling. It ages you. It's horrible. It's really like, it's not fun. I mean, Sandler made it fun, which was awesome about him, but it's not a good time to be, you know? I mean, you're trying to will this thing into existence. Everything, all the powers that be are trying to kind of, you know, put you out and smite you in a weird
way. You're constantly trying to find ways to like one up the system because nothing wants you to make it the way you want to make it.
So it's terrible.
Do you think that changes no matter how much money?
Of course.
And
you end up always finding yourself at the limit.
Right.
Of
so even if you have Michael Bay or Steven Spielberg,
you're always going to be like, if only we had an extra day.
Well, I hear that Tarantino's sets are very fun. I hear that he designs them to be very fun, which is awesome. When the production's starting, it's like doomsday in a weird way. It's like, okay, this day. And you would just hope that something happens so that it will be pushed a little bit.
And also the whole, what we're at least trying to do is get people to not think about all of that structure that's around it. So you kind of want people to, you want to be moving at a speed that people can't really stop and look around. So
we went to this, A24 did this pop-up for the film to promote it in New York. And I was there and Joe showed up. Mm-hmm. Joe Alashayev, he owns a building on 47th Street. And he was one of the first jewelers, even though he's an owner of the building, he was one of the first people to really embrace us on the block. For a while, no one was really embracing us.
And so if you're not in New York City, you haven't been here, Diamond District is 47th Street.
Between 5th and 6th,
It's almost entirely sort of populated by Jews.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Except now, particularly on the street level, Bukharian Jews, which are a small minority within a minority itself.
I just learned about the Bukharian Jews.
Yes.
They're in Queens, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. They're Uzbeki. They're either jewelers or haircutters.
It's super specific.
Yes.
Only a New York experience.
Yes.
I got a ring there once. It's a crazy scene.
Yeah, for sure. And they're from Uzbekistan, and they're amazing people. They're very colorful, and they're fun once you get in, you know, but they're close-knit, so they don't really let a lot of people in. And he was one of the few people who did let us in. And I remember at one point we were, like 6 years ago, we were doing some sort of barter system because I had connections to this great interior designer who has since passed, rest in peace, Jim Walrod. And he was a friend, and he's like, oh, I'll come. He'd done hotels and stuff. He's like a cool guy. And he was like, oh, I'll come and I'll design this thing for this guy and no charge. He was just wanted to help us get the movie made. And then I contacted this like recent architect grad, and we were going to design an Uzbeki lounge on the top of this building on 47th Street in exchange for 6 months of free rent in his building so we could shoot there. And this guy, he saw the movie and he loved it.
Really?
He said the last hour was unbelievable. This is he doesn't watch a lot of movies, Joe, but he came and his son, who appears in the movie as an extra,
they were in the pop-up together.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
And Joe is in it, yeah, and he was so excited. He goes, that last hour was incredible. He just couldn't believe it. And he was reminiscing. He's like, do you remember when you were going to build me the lounge? And to him, it was. And then he said this incredible thing. He's looking around the pop-up. He goes, what is this? They selling the stuff? and I was, because to him, commerce is such a binary thing. You know what I mean?
Thing, you're going to buy it. This is how much it costs.
Exactly. Yeah. Here we are in this promotional thing where nothing's actually for sale. Didn't understand. He couldn't compute. And he was looking around. I was like, no, this is promotional. And he just didn't.
You couldn't buy the Furbies?
They weren't for sale.
Oh, they weren't
they
for
will
sale,
be
right?
for yeah. sale, but they weren't for sale
there. It was just
like there.
Showing them.
Yeah, because it wouldn't be fair to only make it available to people
I
who
can
are
buy a Furby from you guys?
Not from us. A24 is using the person who built our Furby for the film. They built a more affordable version of
They're
it.
They're pretty fantastic.
Yeah.
How active are you guys in the distribution and marketing part of it? Are you hands-on?
It's helpful yet to not be.
I remember when with IFC when they released our first movie and stuff, I was so involved. And then I really regret that because I actually really like seeing a corporation or whatever come in and market.
So you want to create the thing every
I want to be involved in that stuff.
And then you want to hand it over and say,
feedback, but like it's not our expertise.
Well,
you know what I mean? I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I know how to do that.
It's a little bit different this time because it's like with that first movie with IFC, there wasn't really a lot of marketing weight behind it. You know, literally I was standing outside of a movie theater handing out pamphlets convincing people to go to our film.
Come
and
see
not,
the movie.
And not others. So I would literally see people waiting for tickets and be like, don't buy that, buy this movie. And they're like, who says? I'm like, me.
You're
I
like
made
the guys
it.
In the village in front of the comedy
exactly.
store.
We made a sandwich board. And
yes,
he was,
And so that was literally that was how we marketed it. And I remember they let me use their copy machine. And I was like, they're like, just don't do too many copies.
Jelani's nodding. We should do this for podcasts.
It was just like, it was an issue that I was going to use up all the toner. You know, that's kind of the level that it was at. And so now, there's a little bit more weight behind it. So you can actually watch and see some of this stuff through somebody else's eyes, which is pretty cool.
And do you
like
have
that Christmas spot is unbelievable. Do you have
thoughts about sort of like, I think this is a movie that's going to reach this kind of audience, or my friends are using Instagram. Let's make sure we promote it there, but they're not on TikTok. Let's not do that.
I love TikTok.
There you go.
I do like TikTok.
So you have thoughts about that stuff, or you're again, like, they'll lay
think
out.
It, we think the movie's for everybody, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, we want to be on like.
It's in a weird way, like our buddy Sean Price Williams, he would always mock us that he thinks you guys really believe that your movies are for everyone. I was like, he's like, that's not a put on. I was like, no, that's real, man. We genuinely believe that because you don't want to feel, you feel less lonely if you're like, oh, everyone kind of is interested in this.
Do you remember the old guy who used to own the building where we had our office out of? He's like, why isn't Daddy Long Legs on TNT every weekend?
Oh, and the old office?
Yeah. I was like, yes,
our landlord finally. Was just like, he saw the movie and he loved it. And he was just like, he's like, I don't get it. Like, this is a big movie. And we're like, yeah, we agree. But, you know, not many other people agree. But I don't know. I think that, you know, you make the movie and then, you know, you, particularly when you're working with someone like Rudin, who's like, he's, and A24, they're both so great at it that I don't want to get involved. Filmmaking is a fascistic art form. You know what I mean? It's authoritarian. You have directors disseminating.
We're not collaborating here. I'm making a thing.
It is very collaborative, but ultimately you need authoritarian. You need the iron fist. You need it. The process depends on that. It needs it. Even though it's super collaborative, you know what I mean? It's more collaborative than almost in any other art form, but it needs this weird, strange kind of almost communistic like Russian communistic, like
taskmaster.
Yes, exactly. Or just like, this is it. So when it comes to, and I believe that that's the case a little bit when it comes to the release and the marketing, like you need somebody. And luckily, you know, again, like A24 and Rudin, they have this great vision for it. I don't want to get involved. Like when we came in, they showed us the posters, you know, they presented the poster that is the image for the film. And it looked like an iconic. I said, "This guy, this looks like one of your iconic plays." You know, what I mean, this looks like Arthur Miller almost. You know, so I just was. And then when they showed the trailers, my reaction to the one that went quite viral was, I was just like, I don't even know. I said, I don't know. I don't know if this is good. I just don't know.
It's strange because, yeah, at some point you're maybe a little bit too close to make those decisions of how to skew things and what will translate. But with that poster, the way I knew it was like, okay, this is even though I already knew we were in good hands, you know what yeah. I mean? But when you saw the ones they rejected, you're like, okay.
Well, no, they said, we yes. just, you want to see what yes. else was out there. They only showed us two. Okay, let's take to the other show.
And there were like, right? there were 300.
On each end, and then there's one of them.
There were 300 where you were just like, oh my goodness.
What I mean, they're experimenting.
Of course,
yeah.
but still, you could see the mind working through and trying to figure it
out. So I've seen three of your movies, one in a screening room, uh-huh. full screening room, which is nice. And then the other two I saw at home. I rented Good Time and watched in my basement. And then I watched Lenny Clark, which is a great documentary.
Lenny Cook,
thank you. I keep calling it Clark.
Larry Clark.
I'm legally required to ask you how you feel about people watching on their phone or their laptop versus in a theater. I'm assuming you prefer the theater.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not. I admit, like, you know, one of the most memorable movie watching experiences I watched on a cell phone on the street.
What was that?
It was Christiane F. With the lead actress from Heaven Knows What.
No idea what those things are.
Heaven Knows What is a movie we made. And
oh, that's your junkie movie.
Yes. It's
I deem that one too intense for me.
It is, you know, it's looking, I can't, there was a screening recently and I didn't want to watch it.
It's
a dark movie. I was in a dark place.
When you say it's a dark movie,
yeah,
because
I was in a dark time in my life, yeah. and I made the movie, and I'm proud of it, and it was very important for us, and I love the movie, but it's just dark, and there's a lot of darkness surrounding the film. But anyway, when we made that movie, I was with Ariel, who's the lead of the film. And she had never seen that movie, and she had heard about this character, Christiane F. So I said, oh, let me show it to you. And I found a stream on my phone, and I just sat there. It was 30 degrees outside, and we just sat and watched the entire thing, shared earphone experience. It was very memorable. It was a very memorable experience. But at the same time, like, I think in this day and age, going to the theater is very, very important. I think that I can't tell you how many times I've had a collective experience. Like when you go, particularly with Uncut Gems, watching it with an audience, I've done it a handful of times. I've never seen anything like it before because it's such a tense movie, but you have, you know, and everyone's leaning forward, but you have these weird barrage of laughter moments and you can feel like everyone's kind of rooting together. And the only thing you can really liken it to is like live sporting event. Mm-hmm. But it's different than that because it's so personal for everybody. And I just think that the other day we were in New York, we were doing a Q&A uptown and we wanted to watch the last 20 minutes of the movie and you watch it with this packed audience and it was really like nothing else. Like it sitting next to a stranger and watching something so personal. And it's a personal experience for everyone who goes there. And you know everyone's just like also just gripped by it. And I don't care if people use phones or anything like that. I don't care. I'm not a precious movie going. As long as you're not distracting me, I don't really care. And even when you're distracting me, it doesn't really bother me
you
either.
You don't care if they use phones in the theater?
I don't really care. No, I mean, I don't. I'm not a Nazi
you're not,
like
you're
that.
Not a shush
you know? No, I'm not going to ever be that guy. Put that away. I'll never be that person. Because you know what? You got your own life. I got my life.
Yeah, I'm invested in this movie.
Yeah. But I'll say this. I didn't see any phones out in the movie. And like people use phones in movies. And that's something everyone has to accept. You know what I mean?
You guys got Scorsese to work on this one, right? He's a producer.
He got involved after that movie, Heaven Knows What.
So
did Pattinson got involved after that movie as well.
And Robert Pattinson's in Good Time. And I want to ask you about the casting in a second. But so he just came out with, my mind just broke.
Irishman.
3.5 hours. Mm-hmm. I watched it. Multiple sittings at home. He despairs over that. But it seems like if you're good, that's a great encapsulation of the trade, right?
Yeah.
Netflix gave him the money so he could make it. He couldn't make it otherwise.
Yeah,
and then he gives up the idea that you're going to be able to watch.
Well, I read that
where you're going to be able to watch it.
He says, well, I read that he talked about it because he knew where it was going to be, that he experimented with how long he could make it. You know, that was like something he was in his head, at least. But yeah, it depends. Yeah, it's like Josh was saying.
I think
there are certain experiences that
whatever you get from it, however you get it, it doesn't really matter.
But do you think
I can't imagine watching Irishman in multiple sittings.
Yeah.
I just can't. For some reason.
I think I would like it a lot more if I sat in the theater because the intensity would sort of wash
there's
over.
There's something about a movie about a lifetime.
But
you know
I also
what I mean?
Can't imagine carving out 3.5 hours to go to the
it is. The thing is there it used to be that, like, oh, when you were on an airplane, that was the moment you could turn off. Like now it's the movie theaters and the bathroom, really, the only places you can kind of not talk to anybody else. You know, you can just go in and lose yourself.
I think that the 3.5 hours. I mean, why all of a sudden in this day and age, how can we not carve out? You know what I mean? I think it's important. I mean, I think about that often, about time and how you use it. I think it's important to humble yourself with other stories.
Well, that's I'd love to have the time.
Yeah.
And I get that I spend time all kinds of ways, but it'd be very hard for me to carve that out.
Yeah. No, I get it.
There was something exciting going to see it in the theater, knowing that you were in for that.
I didn't find it to be that long.
It wasn't long.
I don't think I thought about the runtime once while I was watching
it. You get, by sitting through it, you actually get the full feeling of the life, you know, in a way that I don't know if you would get if you split it up.
Yep. Just got the 2-minute warning. You're professional.
My art professional, yes.
Still don't know how you got Adam Sandler. How do you get to Adam Sandler? How do you convince him to make this movie?
It took 10 years to convince him. We got the no in 2011. Then
how do you get to him to begin with?
So we,
actually,
after
we
Daddy
we
Long
never
Legs,
really got to him.
Well,
until,
this will be interesting for people to hear. After Daddy Long Legs, our first two movies, we had made this experimental movie that was like not supposed to really exist, and it does. And then we did Daddy Long Legs, and they were both at the Cannes Film Festival. And when we were there, we were getting kind of these incoming requests to meet with agencies. And I was so disinterested with it. I didn't understand it, didn't want to be a part of it. I was like, yuck, leave me alone. And then when we said, okay, this is the next one we want to do, Gems, we knew it was a big film. We knew it was an expensive movie because of the world that you're in. It was a materialist film. And we knew we needed a star. So we said, all right, well, let's start this process by getting an agent. So we got this agent. And then the agencies all speak to each other. And, you know, it's like the mainframe of the industry. And that we started there. And we went out from one agent to basically his management. And we couldn't get this. You know, big stars have a moat. They have their castle and they have their walls. And then they have the moat around the walls. And we couldn't get over the moat to even get to Sandler. So we ended up...
You guys are basically unknown. Like, you're at the point where you can get to the Cannes Film Festival, but no one outside that...
And we won, like, a Spirit Award and a Gotham Award, and we were like, okay...
So if you're a film hipster, maybe you've heard of it.
Exactly, And it was just like... In hindsight, it was like, who did we even think we were to even go to someone like Adam Sandler? Like, who the fuck did we think we were? It's crazy. So we tried, and we couldn't even reach him. Then 5 years later... 4 years later, we made Heaven Knows What. And then this is before Scorsese attached himself, or maybe it was right around the same time. And before we made Good Time, and we were like, let's try again. And we'll take this other modicum of critical success that we had and try to get Sandler again. Again, we couldn't get to him. And then it took Good Time. Good Time was the movie that made contact, and we used it, you know, Pattinson's a big star, and I don't think that that's the reason. The irony is that
we did this with a big star.
But the irony is that Sandler responded most to our film Daddy Long Legs when he went back and watched our other films. So that's the irony. So it takes persistence, and it takes...
parlay everything into the...
Yeah, and it takes... Yeah, exactly. It takes educating yourself and keep working and working.
Was there going to be a version that didn't have Adam Sandler?
We tried, but it didn't.
We went down a road with, you know, trying to convince Sacha Baron Cohen. We did these table readings with him. That never came to fruition. And then when Scorsese got involved, then we went down a road where, like, we were going to maybe make a movie with a peer, with Jonah Hill. That never really happened.
I would see either of those movies.
Yeah, I mean, it was different. And we never could figure out a way to age the character down. So then when Jonah became unavailable with his film and his filmmaking, that we were like, okay, well, this is meant to be. Let's go back to Sandler. Let's try one more shot. And it happened.
I'm glad you got him. I'm glad you made the movie. I'm glad you made time. Benny, you're sick. Thank you. Extra credit for showing up.
Thanks,
guys.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Awesome.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.